And good morning, everyone, once again, and welcome to another episode. And you know I do like that phrase because it so describes what's going on. Another episode of The Other Side of Midnight. That kind of different time between dusk and dawn where the things we, you know, look at in daytime and say, oh, give me a break. At this time of night, well, you can't quite get rid of them that easily. Like, for instance, this story we've been following. As you know, Greg Ahrens and Joseph Farrell and I and a few other folks are honing in on what in the world is so extraordinarily intriguing about Bariloche, this little place, this German resort, this enclave of post-World War II Nazism following the war, at the southern tip of the southern continent in this hemisphere, almost at the tip of the world. There's this little place which, oddly enough, incredibly enough, turns out to have the mirror latitude of Cydonia on Mars, the place which got me into all of this many decades ago through what I call the Martian doorway. Well, tonight we're going to take an incredible leap back in time through the work of another amazing researcher who's put more puzzle pieces together. Remember, the theme of this show is Burkean connections. We even had James on the show, kind of giving us our blessing. And boy, are we connecting dots all over, not just the planet, but the whole damn inner solar system, and, of course, the outer solar system. So, to continue the continuing saga of Bariloche and the weird quinky-dinkies, as a friend of mine used to call synchronicities, let me bring in first tonight our roving correspondent, Greg Ahrens, second in command over at the Enterprise over on Facebook. Greg, what new nuggets of remarkable serendipity have you discovered about Bariloche tonight?
Okay, hi, Richard.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, there's a little town just north of Bariloche that's called Villa La Angostura, and you know, it's basically in the same neighborhood. It's just maybe about 20 miles up the lake.
Right, and we should also go back to Radio with Pictures. Remember, othersideofmidnight.com, upper right-hand corner, Radio with Pictures. Click on that. Takes you to the night's guest page. The first item in my items, the graphic, the huge graphic, kind of a little fuzzy there, but you click on it, it gets crystal clear, is a comparison that Greg found for us just last week. I mean, this story's moving at warp 9. You found this on Google Earth just last week. If you click on item number 1, the brightly lit oceanic view with the bizarre tetrahedron scattered all over the upper left-hand quadrant is a Google Maps image you found looking straight down by satellite on Bariloche.
Right. This is on the lakefront, right by the cathedral. The cathedral's in the lower right corner of the picture there.
And that's a big cathedral.
Yeah. And the tetrahedrons, and it's a swimming pool and a sports complex. And a pier.
Don't forget the pier. It turns out, Greg, the pier is really important. It just hit me when I was loading the pictures for this evening. Robin and I went to Chichen Itza, we had to go by cruise ship, from Galveston down to the northern coast of Venezuela. Then we took a bus inland for a couple hours to get to Chichen Itza. Well, at the end of that pier where we docked, a mile, 2 mile long pier, I recorded the most astonishing torsion field hyperdimensional readings of anything I've ever recorded anywhere, including the sacred sites. The ocean was pumping that 2 mile long concrete pier in a series of oscillations that generate intense torsion field waves, which the Accutron was picking up. That geometry is identical to what I'm looking down on in this orbital photograph there at Bariloche on the shores of the lake. It looks to me like this sports complex is a cover for a hyperdimensionally driven Accutron sensitive energy source in the torsion field that if we ever go there, we could probably detect.
Okay, that sounds good. I'm not sure what the material. I've seen some pictures of the pier. It looks like it's actually an old It's mostly wood, I think, or old fishing pier, old boat pier. That's not the pier where the big boats
right,
come in.
Right,
that,
it's not,
but,
no.
But it's just an old... But it could be what you say, because there's a lot... It's windy down there, and there's a lot of waves.
You can see in the data on the ship when we docked that morning, you know, remember, everything has a natural resonance, like swings, like pendulums and all that. So if you're pumping energy in with surf, you know, surf's up, there's a frequency to the waves coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. Gosh, I hope I wasn't doing something when someone's driving. I don't want to put them to sleep. Anyway, so there you can see in the data these peaks rhythmically every second and a half because of the waves sloshing the pier, generating the torsion field action. Something similar could be going on here. Just a thought, because there's so much weirdness. I mean, the reason that you're on is if you go back to Radio with Pictures, and we scroll down to item number 5. This is a surface shot, beautiful color shot, of the ESA antenna on the ground north of Bariloche.
Right. This is in Malargue, or Marlagui. And it was... Okay. I was on Wednesday morning. Thursday morning, during your show, the Rosetta mission released this picture on their Space and Images page. And they basically had this story about this is the antenna that was being used when the little Philae lander landed on Comet 67P.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 74 weeks ago. And so they were celebrating the 74th week anniversary.
Whoa. Who celebrates 74 weeks?
Right.
Anything. Come on.
Right. So they
heard you basically say, I can't find any satellite images of this antenna complex north of Bariloche. And bingo, within hours later.
A day later, 24 hours later.
Okay. There they give it to us.
They give it to us. Well, yeah, and so it was the headquarters is in Darmstadt, Germany, directing this. Hmm. And they were downloading from the Philae to the Rosetta to Argentina to Darmstadt.
Amazing.
So this is the German space program. I mean, it's called European Space Program, but this is the German space program operating out of Argentina. So... maybe something that came down at that time, maybe more of it came down than what we know about.
Wouldn't that be a surprise? Well, Greg, thank you so much, because that will segue elegantly into the next part of the program. If everybody goes on Radio with Pictures and looks at item number 3, click on item number 3. That was the focus of our conversation with Dr. Paul LaViolette last night, where we discussed this remarkable invention, this technology, through a colleague of his, Dr. Nisikas, there in Athens at the university. And we were discussing basically the invention of what could be the first democratizable, every man can have one, space drive. And the reason I want you to click on that link is because this is the original Dick Tracy... item number 3, click on it, Dick Tracy magnetic air car and moon car, basically, you know, democratizing this kind of technology decades before LaViolette and Nisikas have figured it out. So what we're in the process of doing, which we did last night, was to help them launch their Indiegogo campaign to raise enough money now through this audience and other audiences we connect with. And that's where you connect to item number 2 under Radio with Pictures tonight. That's the Indiegogo campaign. That takes you to the Indiegogo page where all of this background, the physics, the theory, the papers, the experiments, the videos, and all that we discussed here last night is visible. And as you can see, in the 24 hours since Paul was on the show yesterday morning, 24 hours later, this audience has raised about $1,000. That's about $1,000 more than was there last night at the same time. So keep going. this is the way we're going to crowdsource this technology to a phase two demonstrator, which, as I said last night, is going to be phenomenal in that if it works as the theory and the first experiments indicate, it is going to produce in excess of 150 pounds of thrust for a payload of less than, 10, 11 pounds, which means you can use that to basically hover. And by adjusting weights and other instrumentation, you can make it just float, effortlessly from room to room. And there will be video of that and a live demo. And if you guys help Paul and Dr. Nikas do this in the proper way, then history changes a page. Life changes. This is a game changer. This changes everything, including the possibility of tracking back to what my guest of this morning has been working on for some years, and that is who actually on this planet first realized that these kind of physics and technology were not, in fact, impossible, because they had quiet proof, a heritage extending back thousands, if not tens of thousands of years, to a previous but unacknowledged by academia high-tech civilization, maybe more than one, and a long epoch of civilizations extending back to our work, the time frame for our trying to figure out what's been going on in this neighborhood, i.e. the Type II civilization, at a time horizon of something like 65 million years. Walter Bosley was born in San Diego, but quickly was transported to Mothman Country, I think that means southern Indiana and Kentucky, when his dad packed up the family to return to his hometown in Parkersburg, West Virginia, where Walter spent the first few years of his life before returning to Southern California somewhat later. Strange tales of the mysterious Indrid Gold were part of the lore of Walter's childhood, along with horror movies at the drive-in, and UFOs. Aside from a second brief foray to West Virginia, Walter grew up in the Inland Empire, from which he would write many years later. Walter returned to San Diego for college and then briefly worked as a production assistant in the film industry until his mentor, and we'll get into that, got hold of him and aimed Walter at the FBI. Walter became a counterintelligence specialist for the Bureau, working in the San Francisco Division, studying Russian while assigned to Baltimore, and then monitoring wiretaps on GRU agents working in Manhattan during the last years of the Cold War. In 1993, Walter reported to USAF Officer Training School and served his entire active duty as a special agent of the AFOSI, an acronym we'll describe momentarily. His longest assignment at Wright-Patterson as a counter-espionage agent, during which time he also served on deployment to Saudi Arabia. Military service was followed by 6 years as an operational consultant on counterterrorism, an occupation that took him to the Middle East, Central Asia, Africa, Eastern and Western Europe, South America, and the Philippines. World travel gave Walter the opportunity to see ancient sites and encounter such interesting exotica, and it also had its share of close calls. During those years, Walter took the opportunity to travel with David Hatcher Childress and the Wex Club to the Mayan sites of central Mexico and the Inca sites of Peru and Bolivia. Two of Walter's articles have been published in Wex magazine. After 19 years in national security, Walter Bosley became a licensed private investigator in California, where he also runs his small press publishing company, Lost Continent Library, founded in 2002. Walter is best known for his investigation, of seven mysterious deaths in 1915's San Bernardino, for which he proposes were motivated by a dark occult philosophy and black magic. Oh, just goody, the kind of thing for Hollywood. Walter has also written about the esoterica engineering of Disneyland. Now there's an intriguing connection. The mystery of Western legend Etta Place, the Zodiac Killer, the lost world of Joan of Arc, the mystery of Spanish explorer Juan Cabrillo, The Lost Expedition of Sir Richard Francis Burton, and Breakaway Civilizations. Obviously, Walter's not going to be sleeping for the next week as he regales this audience with all of this interesting information and more. Good morning and welcome to the other side of midnight.
Well, thank you, Richard. It's good to be here.
We're just going to tie you to that chair so you make sure that they bring stuff in. And I mean, how can I am holding a book in my hand. I got to compliment you. You got it into my hands. It's an old-fashioned physical book. I can you know, do this. I can you know. And it reads and it looks amazing. Back when, way back when I was making the rounds of trying to sell my book, my first one, Monuments of Mars, I wandered into the studio at Westwood One with Tom Snyder. Mm-hmm. And we're doing radio. Remember, this is radio. This is radio without pictures back then. But what I had done is I brought up a case, like an artist case, filled with 11 by 14 and 16 by 20s mounted on mat board. So I put the photographs, these huge photographs of Cydonia, the face, the pyramids, the other pyramids, the city, the tholus. I put them around this conference room, which was the studio, with the only people being Tom and me, and a whole bunch of surrogates from Mars, from Cydonia, from this ancient, ancient dead civilization, staring Tom in the face during the whole show. Mm-hmm. And he looks at me, and he looks at them, and he says, "This has got to be the weirdest radio show I've ever done." So then we get into my work, and I start telling him about the title, and I lay it on him. I said, you know, "The Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever." And he says, Hoagland, he says, "That has got to be the best damn book title I have ever seen." I have to tell you, Walter Bosley, I am holding the next best book title I have ever seen. Origin, the 19th century emergence of the 20th century breakaway civilizations. And it is set and it is artistically created in such a way to demand, to implore, to insist, to command that you not put this book down until you finish it. And the conflict I've had over the last several days, having to get ready to do other things and wanting to do this, just this, I mean, you've created something which is so connective in a show which is about connecting. So where should we begin? What got you into this? How did you wind up going from counterintelligence and spooks in the night to thinking maybe this civilization is not exactly what we think it is?
Yeah. Well, first, thanks for the high praise, and I hope that in the next couple of hours, you know, what we talk about, I can deliver and live up to, you know, the impression so far. But yeah, a lot of people ask me exactly what you asked me. You know, how did you go from that to this? And the fact is, all this interesting stuff, like what we're going to talk about tonight, and some of the other things I've researched, were actually the original interests which my aforementioned mentor realized early on I was interested in, and that was what our early discussions were about. And he just kind of lured me in a little bit with the career path, and he suggested,
"Oh, young man, join the Navy, see the world."
Yes, exactly. He suggested, in fact, his line was, you know, "You're interested in all these curious and strange things, and one way you can find out more about them is by going into this line of work." And
at first, that sounds so much like an intel friend that Robin and I have, a mutual friend who shall remain nameless. I think I referred to him one night on George's show as deep source, deep mm-hmm. space, mm-hmm. deep space. Yes. Well, deep space is in that same murky world, and sometimes uh-huh. you get good stuff and you get weird stuff. So how do you, I mean, it's almost like, did you pick up whispers in the corridors of people who know a lot more about this than we know? And that, I mean, that's where you got your heads up that, wait a minute, maybe the 20th, 21st century is not exactly, there's stuff going on in the back rooms that are
right.
the reality, and, you know, this universe is really kind of like another Marvel version.
Well, you know, it's funny, about the same time that, you know, he was working on me, I was...
This invisible mentor, does he have a name? Do we have a code name for him?
Yes, actually, he just passed away last
week. Oh, I'm sorry.
And I He's passed away. His first name was Jake.
Okay.
And about
can,
the time
can we allude to what agency or agencies he worked with and how many presidents and that kind of thing?
All I knew for certain that I can say was that he had spent several years in Army Special Forces.
Okay.
And he was in the 101st Airborne and all that, and then he was brought into the intelligence world, and that's honestly about as far as I can go. But about the time he was working on me, I was kind of rereading and re-educating myself on UFO history, okay, because I had been interested in that from childhood, greatly thanks to my dad.
Did you guys, did your mentor and you ever talk about Walter Friedman?
No.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you will have to discuss him so I can learn about him.
Yep, but yep. I thought there might be a nexus point there, but anyway, please continue.
So, honestly, this was in spring of 1986, and it was the first time for me now. Other people had gone there before me, had figured this out before me, but the first time for myself, I realized, hey, wait a minute, there's something going on here about these some of these UFOs that the evidence suggests that this is more human activity, classified human activity, and maybe they're letting people think it's ET as a good cover for what's being done secretly. And that was, for me, the first time I had that little epiphany. And
well, that's an incredibly heretical thought. So what was it about the data that made you say, wait a minute, family, human beings?
The first thing, honestly, was reading about the stuff in the World War II era and the what did they call them? The mystery rockets or whatever. But these things were.
You mean the so-called Foo Fighters?
Well, the Foo Fighters were part of it, but people were describing these cigar-shaped UFOs, and they were seeing them, I guess, in Scandinavia,
right,
or
up in the upper of the latitudes, yeah.
Yeah, and Northern Europe, Northern Germany is where, the Nazis were testing, things like the V rockets and stuff. And knowing that, I thought, well, wait a minute here. What these people are describing, this mysterious cigar-shaped thing with the fire coming out the end, that's just a rocket. Isn't it interesting that nobody apparently is coming forward, at the time that I was aware of, and saying, well, those were just – the rockets. So that was the first little, what's going on here? And then from
You're kind of like Joseph. It was exotic, interesting by the times, but it wasn't exotic enough to be interplanetary or certainly interstellar.
Exactly. Yeah, I would say that's the better way to put it. That was the first time I was looking at that kind of stuff in that way. And then subsequently, when I got into the military, of course I was Air Force. I'm an Air Force officer. You learn some things about the different.
We won't hold that against you. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you. The platforms.
Well, the real service is the Navy. That goes way back to John Paul Jones and. All of that complicated symbology and secret history, but you Air Force brats. Okay, go ahead.
So, going into the Air Force and being briefed in on things that I needed to be briefed into, because as an OSI agent, one of my primary early duties on my first assignment was what we call program protection, and that was doing counterintelligence briefings to the contract engineering firms that were building the cool various platforms and vehicles for the Air Force. They needed to know that there were, Russian and Chinese, technical spies out there looking to get our stuff. So you have to be briefed in to a certain level and read in on certain things. And that kind of further convinced me that what you said earlier, that even though this was exotic, clearly it was human technology stuff that was going on here. And it really, really is easier to let people think something is ET rather than reveal it.
Of course. That's a perfect cover. It's like signal in the noise. Who's going to – or throwing spaghetti on the wall or any other cliche we could use.
Right.
So, okay, you're looking at technology, you're looking at stories, you're saying it's not ET, so then what's left?
Exactly. I'm thinking, well, gosh, maybe what we're doing is developing, you know, advanced spacecraft. And at one time,
we mean the human race, meaning the Germans,
yes,
during World War II. Okay.
Oh, the Germans, you know, yeah, we're looking at that. And then, you know, I thought, well, what about at the time, 1986, what about in modern times? You know, the stuff people are seeing, it must be, you know, the nations of the world continuing this kind of research in a general way.
But in top secret, total secrecy. But,
oh, yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, it was classified programs. And again, going back to it, must be easier to let people think that, you know, it's ET doing this stuff than to admit to having something we don't want to admit to yet.
So when did you connect to pre-20th century history?
Okay, that came along years later as I learned more in the late 90s, early 2000s, as I learned more about the airship mystery. Of course, I had been aware of them since, you know, I had read stuff in Jacques Vallée's books from the, you know, in the early 1980s and late 70s stuff. You know, everybody that's read anything about, you know, the UFO history, you're basically aware of the 19th century airship mysteries.
Well,
but you're also
since we have a worldwide audience who may not have read about U.S. airship mysteries, we need to give people a brief précis. We got about 2 minutes.
Oh, okay. The 19th century airship mysteries, specifically in the 1890s, are probably the better known ones. These were large craft, very much human in their technology, but advanced for the time, ahead of their time, and they were being seen all over the major cities of the Western United States and some other places. But the primary focus on the mystery is, you know, all over these cities. And hundreds and thousands of witnesses, in some cases, were reportedly seeing them. And this was going on for a couple of years, and then all of a sudden it stopped. And after that, it pretty much was written off as just a mass hoax. And nothing to see here, folks. Nothing went on here. You know, go about your business.
Now, who had the power to close it down? William Randolph Hearst?
No, I think it was, in my personal opinion, particularly now based on the research that I've done and my speculations and deductions, I would say that it was the breakaways themselves, the people who had the stake in, you know.
But, I mean, they had to control earthly media. Back in those days, it was big newspapers and beginnings of radio.
Well,
so they had to control that just to close down, you know, inquiring minds.
Some say that Hearst himself might have been involved with the investment of such things.
That's so. What I'm wondering. Okay, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a break. Keith has some new music for us tonight, so I've heard. So we'll take a break here. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hogan. My guest this morning, Walter Bosley, who's written an exquisite book. And we're going to get into the book and the origins, the distant, distant origins of so much that now comes together and makes so much sense. You're on the other side of midnight, and yes, we shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight in the land of enchantment tonight under a crescent moon. 60 degrees, Patrick. 60 degree weather floating your way on the balmy breezes of spring. Okay, Walter, what happened that connected you to the possibility that the mysterious airships, the spate of bizarre sightings that were literally from coast to coast, but mostly, as you said, concentrated out here, that they were traceable not just to a human origin, but to a kind of, I don't know, Doctor Strange, E. Doc Lensman, Doc Savage, 1930s comic book, independent, multi-billionaire funded group, basically apart from the whole world. I mean, how did you get the idea that maybe that fiction was not fiction?
Well, that was very interesting. I had written the first book in my Empire of the Wheel series on the strange deaths that you had mentioned in my bio earlier, and I was working on the second book. The first book I wrote with Richard Spence.
Oh, and, our friend, yes, from Utah.
Idaho, yes.
Idaho, I'm sorry. Utah, Idaho.
Yeah. Yeah. And yes, exactly. Rick and I had written the first book and beginning to work on the second, and there was something that had nagged me from the first book, and when I was investigating this, I saw no connection to the airship mystery. Now, at that time, I had read the works of, you know, the guys who pretty much blazed this trail on this airship mystery stuff, specifically, and we'll get into this more, but specifically this mysterious Sonora Aero Club. I'd read Pete Navarro and Dennis Crenshaw's book, The Secrets of Del Shau. I'd read Mike Busby's book on the solving the 1897 airship mystery. I'd read Theo Pyman's work in which he talks about the NIMSA and the airships in his Keeley book. And I had read Sean Castile's book about, you know, the Tesla journey to Mars.
Hmm.
What was interesting was I had heard of the Sonora Aero Club, read a little bit about it through the airship mysteries, and in my mystery that I was investigating here in San Bernardino that occurred in 1915, there was one individual who had been – now, remember, this was in a season where there were already five mysterious deaths, two of them children who had been given poison candy, okay? For all they knew – they had some type of, you know, killer, or what we'd call a serial killer.
I was going to say, in those days, serial killings were totally unheard of. So having, what, five deaths in a cluster in a few months?
Yeah, a few weeks and days.
Oh, my God, even shorter. So this was a big deal for 1915.
For San Bernardino, 1915.
Where you'd leave your door open, you'd leave your windows open, there'd be pies on the kitchen window, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, there's this one individual who was from out of town. He was arrested on the train during this period, this strange death. He was arrested on a train heading out of town to Barstow, and he was essentially having a nervous breakdown. He was hallucinating, and he kept saying that he's being persecuted for hurting a woman, for hurting a woman. And he had in his possession a woman's purse with a couple of $100s in it. Well, he's taken by the police to the county hospital, and he's put on the psych ward, and he's diagnosed as being dangerously paranoid. However, he is almost immediately released into the custody of unidentified friends from Sonora, was how the newspaper put it. Well, you know.
Now, when you say Sonora, we're talking the Sonoran Desert in Southern California, right?
We're talking Sonora, California, the town up by Yosemite.
Okay.
But here, you know, just – it's like, who are these mysterious friends from Sonora that can just come get this guy who's been diagnosed as dangerously paranoid, who's arrested on the train in possession of a woman's purse, and the last victim had been a mysterious woman who was poisoned and drowned in the lake of the local park, and he's having a nervous breakdown, and he's just released into their custody. And I'm thinking, these must be some powerful, you know, influential guys, whoever they were. Mm-hmm. So I had the option of, okay, they were either from Sonora, Mexico. They were either from Sonora, I think it's out in Texas, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
Or could it be, at the time I was aware of the Sonora Aero Club, but I thought, nah, it couldn't be the Sonora Aero Club. Well, the name of the gentleman was Frank Rosasco. And sure enough.
The guy who was supposed to be going nuts.
The guy who was losing it on the train, the young man, 24 years old. And I looked up, I did research on the Rosasco name, and lo and behold, up there where Sonora, the town, is Tuolumne County, which is very – it is the heart of the mysterious Sonora Aero Club airship country, and this is where – this guy was from. He was part of the Rosasco ranching family. Very well known. Okay. Very well known.
Okay,
so
now. Sonora Aero Club. For those of us that have not followed this mystery, what the heck is important about the Sonora Aero Club?
Wow. They were a group of mostly German immigrants. There's a foot stomper right there, Richard, as we know. German immigrants living in Sonora, California, who were allegedly building some form of – using some form of anti-gravity. They were building little flying contraptions.
Did they advertise this? This is what we're building airships based on anti-gravity?
Oh, no. This was something that they operated and acted almost like a Masonic lodge would. They were very secretive. They would take their these arrows, they called them AEROs, the spelling. They would take their arrows and they'd go out into the countryside up there in Tuolumne County. And many times they would wait until there was a big holiday or festival going on in town, so everybody would be in town, and they would go out to this area by the hills and the canyons and fly these contraptions. What's interesting is their favorite place to fly these, get this, became the Sonora Airport.
Okay. Now, we're talking the early years of the 20th century, right?
Oh, no, Richard. Oh, no. The Sonora Aero Club, we're talking the 1850s.
Well, the you connected it to the five deaths in 1915, so I assume – so you're now backtracking. We'll do that, right? Backtracking.
Well, yeah, well, you had asked me to explain the Sonora Aero Clubs.
Right.
Here's the interesting thing. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You pointed out something good there, and that is that I find an interesting connection to Sonora, California in 1915, and I'm aware of this 1850s Sonora Aero Club. And so I have to ask myself, why and how might they be so influential so many years later, 65 years later? And that was a thread right there that when I pulled it, led me to more and more and resulted in this this theory that I presented about these 19th century breakaways and them developing this anti-gravity technology.
Okay, so we've got a bunch of German immigrants that come into this part of California in 1850, set up something called the Sonora Aero Club. They're doing something mysterious with things that float in the sky. They're not biped planes. They're not, balloons. They're nothing normal. But they mask it all in secrecy. And they apparently have a longevity for 65 years to where they show up again, involved somehow intersecting in the five mysterious deaths in San Bernardino, which is how far away from Sonora?
It is about a five-hour drive.
Okay.
Yeah.
But by arrow, it's quicker.
Yes, it would be.
Okay. So when we pull on this thread in 1850, what do we find?
We find that we find two things that really jump out at us that are the main line connecting us to the 20th century, and that is the Germans already mentioned, but more specifically, the alleged technology used in these arrows. It is suspiciously like the Nazi bell.
Oh. A conical cone-shaped device with mysterious innards that produces maybe thrust, maybe anti-gravity. Gosh, that sounds like the superconducting thruster that I'm pushing on tonight's show.
And we even have a picture of it people can look at if they go to number 12.
Okay, radio with pictures. Everybody go there.
Walter Bosley. Yeah. Number 12.
Going down. These are very nice professionally produced slides.
Oh, thank you. I did them myself for my presentation.
Your design sense is really interesting. So we want number 12.
Number 12. Okay. And if you see that there, you will see the shape.
Oh, now, yeah. That's a torsion geometry. Come on.
Exactly. Now, this drawing was done in the late 1800s by the very interesting and somewhat mysterious Charles Delschau, a German immigrant himself, who is the source of our knowledge of the Sonora Aero Club. And he claimed
– he calls it a generator cone.
Yes, exactly. Now, if you go down – scroll down and look at number 13, you will see – how the generator cone.
Holy cow. And you should have number 4 there, which is this little superconducting thruster.
There you go.
Right. I'm serious. It would fit right in.
Now, the thing that people should understand looking at this is that picture of the generator cone, remember, that was drawn 20 to 30 years before the Germans started working on the Bell. Okay, that was not something drawn after the era of the Bell. Right. That was drawn decades before the Germans started working on the Germans of the 20th century.
Let me do a little setup here because that will make it a little clearer. I'm going to read directly from your book, page 2. First, let me state my position. The breakaway civilizations of our time, a term that I think we can harken back to Richard Dolan, right?
Yes.
He's the first guy that used that?
I believe so, yes.
Of course, he's running at Warp 9. He won't come on the show for some reason. I really want to talk to him about, because he's so mad at me about Elonin. And if we have these folks out there with all this super technology, doing Elonin in all the codes we figured out is you know, you can do it before lunch. It's nothing. It's trivial. It's like showing off. It's like a message to the in crowd, we're God and you're not, and don't you ever forget it. Anyway, let me finish your thing here. The breakaway civilizations of our time are not the product of Nazi Germany. Oh, Joseph, there go all those conversations. Nor are they product of the post-war military-industrial complex, the Eisenhower warning. And they are certainly not the result of reverse engineering of a crashed ET spacecraft, Roswell, Kecksburg, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. To my points, you say. Number one, there was a technologically advanced human civilization in remote ancient history. Check. Actually, many more than one. Two, secret societies and esoterically motivated hermetic organizations sought to recover and reconstruct the lost knowledge and technology of these forgotten ancient civilizations. Check. Number three, the technology of the 19th century airship builders was based on the lost knowledge of forgotten civilizations preserved and rediscovered. Check. Four, Charles Delschau was not simply an outsider artist. He was telling the truth, which means we're going to have to get into who Charles was and what his truth was. So, number five, American airship builders developed aerotechnology in the first black project launched at the end of the Civil War. And number six, 20th century Nazi Germany technology linked to the modern secret space program and breakaway civilization originated with the Prussian airship builders. Okay, we can go home now, because I agree with everything. I've never had a guess where I agree with everything. I agree.
Oh, wow.
I agree with everything. You have totally figured it out. The only missing question is, who was the civilization that lasted long enough to give us this echo of this extraordinary technology? And where did they get it from? And the ones before them,
Right.
In other words, this connects linearly right back to the Great War and our reconstruction of the Type II 65 million years before.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're talking about something yesterday, comparatively speaking. And I've been looking at the real origins, and they connect. You know how they used to build bridges where you put one span out from the right and one from the left, and they're supposed to meet in the middle?
Yes.
Your work and our work and a lot of other people's work are now meeting in the middle. It's really, the dots are there. This is so Burkean. So please continue.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You're talking about, you know, what was that civilization? The farthest I've taken it to is whatever that civilization was that became our Atlantean legend. You know, that's how far back, if you know, and farther. Of course, I agree. That civilization, I think they came here from somewhere else. So there is a touch of the ET influence, but as I say in my book, it's so far back on this specific issue that that it's – you could almost say it's negligible. What it is it was so far back they came here. Their civilization is no more, so to speak. And the organizations like the secret societies organizations like the Royal Society, I've written about this, and you know, philosophical type societies – these are the groups, the human groups, that have gone searching for this data, because through ancient tomes and this parchment and that parchment and this whispered secret there and things they pick up, these guys have put this stuff together. And, you know, it's been a pursuit across the generations to find this and put it together. And I think it happened to start to really come together in the 19th century. And that's why we really see this tremendous leap from 19th century technology into, you know, what we saw in the 20th century. Because, I mean, Richard, when you think that, you know, a little over 100 years or so ago, people weren't driving around automobiles, and you look at what we have now in 2016, that is, I think most people agree, just an incredible leap. Well, what caused that? And I think the answer to what caused it are the things we're talking about here, this pursuit of this lost technology, and finally the industrialization to give us the means to really make it happen.
Okay, so let me limit out very carefully what your model is, which is there was a very distant, ancient, unspecified terrestrial human civilization on this planet, which achieved incredible technological heights beyond where we are now. Okay?
Yes.
So far?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
We don't have to discuss for the moment what came before those guys, but all right.
Right.
So I'm betting that time frame for that was roughly 30,000 years ago, but I could be mistaken, obviously, by plus or minus 10,000, but that's – okay. So your model is that those guys somehow disappear. And thousands and thousands of years later, there are scraps and pieces, bits of – did you ever read a book called Chronicle for Leibowitz? Canticle for Leibowitz.
Oh, my gosh. No, I haven't. But my best friend from high school was a big fan of the book.
But, because that's so the story of what we're talking about. Except it was set in the 50s, post-nuclear war, when this monk is part of a team that's assembling bits and pieces of the time that came before to try to reconstruct civilization. The Egyptian motif is the first time. The Shemsu Hor are a group dedicated over long term, really, really long term, we're talking tens of thousands of years from the Egyptian texts themselves, to basically reconstructing from the scraps and bits and pieces the first time and re-energizing, reborning civilization anew. It sounds to me like your group is one of several groups. You traced one. Pretty good documentation, but there's probably more than one, because if there was a global effort through humanity to make sure we didn't lose the good stuff when we could figure out why it was important, there would have to be multiple efforts, like you know, sperm swimming upstream, that kind of thing.
Right. One of the organizations I wrote about in my previous book that was on this pursuit, my book The Lost Expedition of Sir Richard Francis Burton, was the Royal Society at up until the time that the philosopher scientists were in control of that organization. Now, in the early 1800s, the technical guys kind of began to outnumber the philosopher scientists, and they took the society over, and they really pushed the philosopher scientists aside. Now, you know, when I say philosopher scientists, I mean guys who not only were, you know, Isaac Newton and stuff, brilliant with what we would call hard science, but they were also alchemists. You know, they pursued the hermetic arts. Well, this was something that the technical guys didn't like. They weren't into that. They thought, you know, the society should go in a different direction. So whatever advances the Royal Society was making in pursuit of this lost civilization up to that time, in my opinion, I think the evidence shows that it had to go underground, because professional science would not have and this is where we get the difference between, for instance, in archaeology and anthropology, the diffusionist theory and the versus the isolationist theory. You know, it's that kind of rift. But yes, you know, there is also the Angelic Society, which is this, you know, somewhat mysterious group that people have connected to Jules Verne. You know, how did Jules Verne know about all this stuff that he wrote about? Well, he has, you know, rumored to have been fed the info by the Angelic Society.
Well, how did Edgar Rice Burroughs know all the stuff that came out in that damn Disney movie that had more bizarre, weird, anti-Hollywood stuff going around it? Like it was a tour de force to the in crowd. This is the history you're about to learn about again. In other words, what you and I think of when we started in this field as being so incredibly avant-garde and at the cutting edge is almost now, because of the Marvel comics and Star Wars won Best Movie of the MTV Awards, if that's not a giveaway, it's almost like we have to run to catch up to where the audience is, because they're already used to the idea that George Lucas is writing history, not imagination.
If they're taking it seriously,
and
you're right.
More of them are every moment, every second.
Ah, that's promising for guys like us.
Yeah. Okay, so back to the connection between this German aero club in the middle of nowhere in the 1850s in Southern California and mysterious airships that a lot of people now in the 20th century and 21st think, oh, ATs, UFOs, aliens. And you think it's much more interesting.
Well, yes. By the time we get to the 1890s, remember the Sonora Aero Club issue, this was not something that was reported in papers. This was still what you'd say unknown, you know. It wasn't until the 1890s, specifically 1896 and 1897, the airship mysteries that I mentioned before, where hundreds or thousands of people in major cities in the western U.S. were seeing these airships. Now, yes, physically, when you describe them, you could say, well, they're kind of like Zeppelins, but they were not. They seemed to, you know, they went faster. They were described as going faster. They were described as making an interesting noise when they operated that implied some type of something more than just a combustion engine spinning a propeller around. Mm-hmm. You know, there was something electrical going on, something else going on. And, of course, we have the image of this generator cone. We can now imagine what was going on. And
so you're basically proposing that this was a cadre of secret anti-gravity control ships that merely were looking like airships, lighter than aircraft of the day, to blend in, to masquerade, to camouflage. Where were they from? Who was doing it? And why so many? And why did they suddenly stop? That's a lot of questions. So let's start with who. Who?
Well, here's the interesting thing. The witnesses to a man and a woman, every individual witness, they describe human beings who they encountered, who came from the airship and would have conversations with them.
Okay.
You know, and they would say, hey, you know, we left from, Laramie, Wyoming, and we're going to be down in flying over Cuba, or, you know, we can be in South America by morning, that kind of thing. And, you know, can we borrow some water? And in some cases, a couple of cases, there were two individuals named. Okay, one of them was Samuel Tillman, and the other was Amos Dolbear. Now, here's what's interesting.
Were these witnesses or guys on the ships?
No, these were men from the ships.
Okay.
These were men from an airship. Now, here's the interesting thing. Samuel Tillman, you can Wikipedia him right now. Samuel Tillman was a living, breathing man documented in history, a U.S. Army officer who went on – once World War I broke out later in life, had to become the commandant of West Point. This is a man who really lived, who existed. And there, you know, in the 1890s, before that, there he is being identified as, you know, one of the pilots of these airships, at least, you know, one of the crew officers.
Part of an organization that was fanning out long before World War I to do what?
To build these mysterious airships to fly all over the world. That's the thing. They just implied that they were for exploration. They didn't really go into why they were doing it.
Did you ever see a movie called Things to Come?
Oh, yeah, years ago when I was a kid.
Yeah, that's what you're describing, an organization of flyers banding together around the world to try to change the course of human civilization technologically with advanced technology, airships. And then what happened to them?
Exactly. What happened to them? You know, we're told that they disappeared. Oh, and the other guy that was with Tillman, Amos Dolbear, you can look him up too. He was an accomplished scientist technician, and you know, these were flesh and blood guys. And then this airship mystery ended in 1897, 1898, and we're told that's it. And then we're told in our times, you know, after that in our times, that, oh, it was all these newspaper editors got together and made all this stuff up. It was all a big April Fool's Day hoax, even though it went on for weeks and months and a couple of years. It was all an April Fool's Day hoax. And they had to go somewhere. Now, and as I detail in my book, we started in Sonora with this interesting group of German immigrants in the 1850s. Then we end up in the 1890s, and there's these American guys coming down off these airships and talking with the locals, with the witnesses. And so I asked myself, well, what happened to the Germans? And in pulling those threads and trying to figure this out, what happened to the Germans, I found what I thought in my mind, and this is mostly through, you know, deductive reasoning, is somewhere along the way there was a split off from the Germans. Ah. And the clue to that is when you read the Sonora Aero Club material and you learn that the Germans in California resisted the involvement of their parent group, an even more mysterious organization called NIMSA,
okay,
which was based in what was called Prussia then.
Hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. Top of the hour. Whatever. Yes. Let me go and turn and look at the clock. We're at the top of the hour, yes. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, riveting, Walter Bosley. Did the split between the German group and the American group kind of echo the split between Rothschild and Rockefeller? Are we talking a similar heritage, a similar pattern to own and control the world through manipulating and keeping secret really amazing technology? And does that technology go back, not hundreds, not thousands, but tens of thousands of years on the road back to Sedonia? My name is Richard C. Hoagland. Some more questions, maybe some answers, when we return. And we're back on the other side of midnight on a very, very warm night. It's 60 degrees. Balmy land of enchantment. So, Walter, this group, which may have had a split, you think had access to ancient, ancient, secret, preserve-at-all-cost information, basically about how to manipulate gravity and produce lighter-than-air travel without any of the appurtenances of the 19th century. If you unmute, it usually helps. Hello? Walter? Hello, hello? All alone by the telephone. It's rather mysterious. Most curious. I'm not hearing anyone. Testing one, testing two, testing three. I'm not hearing anything coming back in my ear. And I don't see everything is normal. All the little lights are twinkling properly. The dials are set. But I'm not seeing anybody connecting on Skype. That is so bizarre. Okay, let me try something here. I'm sorry, folks, but obviously this is a subject tonight we're not supposed to be discussing, according to somebody. Okay. Walter, are you back? Hello, Walter. Okay, I see M in the little Skype screen. You know, there's such pluses and minuses of using this technology. Again, it goes back and harkens back for me to Heinlein and his three laws of technology. I'm sure that at some point we will get all this in train. I'm seeing that Bosley is connected, but he's not hearing me.
I am here.
Oh, there you are.
Sorry about that.
What in the world happened?
Oh, I had to go get rid of some of that coffee.
Uh-oh. So we ought to time the breaks a little better. Thank you, Em. Thank you. Okay, so where were we? We were talking about when you found that this split between the German group and the American group was actually trying to tell you something about things that may have happened a lot earlier.
Well, yes. It going back to the thread that I pulled led me back to, well, the Sonora Aero Club and these Germans of the Sonora Aero Club. That really, the guys who were building these things on behalf of this mysterious German-based group called the NIMSA, they were resisting the home office, so to speak. They were resisting their representatives' influence. Essentially, the guys in Germany wanted them to build these with a military application. And the guys, the Germans in California, they did not want these arrows built for a military application.
And we know that how?
This all comes from Charles Delschau.
Okay, and now, who was Charles Delschau? Let's talk about our source here.
Okay, Delschau, an interesting character. He had what we know about him is that he came to California in the mid-1850s from Germany. He transited through Texas, specifically up through the Gulf and through Texas across the Southwest to Sonora. And according to his own diaries, his own story, he was going to California on behalf of the NIMSA, kind of reporting to them on the progress of the Sonora Aero Club.
Let me stop you there, because you mentioned this term several times, NIMSA.
Yes.
NIMSA.
Yes.
NIMSY on the waves. I'm thinking Lewis Carroll. I'm thinking Alice in Wonderland. NIMSA, NIMSY, whimsy, mimsy. What the heck is a NIMSA?
NIMSA.
Spell.
It has – Delschau spelled it – the whole thing with the even the word NIMSA is very interesting. Delschau spelled it N-Y-M-Z-A, and he never
– Z as in zebra?
Z as in zebra, NYMZA, and with capital letters. So it appeared to have been an acronym. And over the years.
But what about Yahweh is spelled with capital letters, and that's not an acronym, is it?
No.
Okay, so NIMSA is a word, capitalized, very important, sacred.
Yes.
It comes from where? Where does Delschau get it?
Well, he just knows it. And it's the organization that he already is aware is the umbrella, the secretive umbrella organization that's kind of in the background sponsoring not just the Sonora Aero Club, but allegedly other unidentified groups working on these arrows.
And traceable through your work back to Prussia?
Traceable through the Delschau's diaries through the work of Pete Navarro, who discovered his art and his diaries in Texas in the early 1970s. And he and Dennis Crenshaw, in their book Secrets of Delschau, share some of that. And, of course, Theo Pyman's, Mike Busby, all these researchers that I mentioned before, Sean Castile and them, and a guy named Stephen Romano, who has published just an outstanding volume of Delschau's actual art and pages from the diary. I mean, you can look at this stuff and see it for yourself. Well, Delschau is our original source on this, and that's what makes it questionable to some folks, because they want to write off what he's saying as fantasy and he's just what they call an outsider artist. The problem we have with that is the fact that we end up having the 1890s airship mystery, and that we end up having what the Germans were doing during World War II, and the smoking gun, you might say, the damning spot, as it were, is that image you see that I showed you of the generator cone that, for all intents and purposes, is the bell of the following century.
Sure, so, looks like the same technology to me.
Exactly. That's what it looks like. So if you do not just write off Delschau and you know, you look at his stuff, what he's saying, and you go out on that limb of, well, let's take it at face value. You know, what you have here, you have these German immigrants that don't want to cooperate with the Home Office. You have the 1890s airship mystery. What happened there? Well, what it looks like happened was in the 1860s, during the war, there was a man named Solomon Andrews who – and this was reported in the newspapers at the time. Solomon Andrews was an inventor back east, and he took his flying machine called the Aeron. Now, think about it. The guys in California were doing Aeros, A-E-R-O, and Andrews did this thing called the Aeron, you know, A-E-R-O-N. Was it a connection or was it just because, you know, the linguistics work out that way?
Yep.
He pitched this flying machine idea to – he got his pitch to Abraham Lincoln. And Lincoln said, this is phenomenal. Let's procure this thing. Let's get this thing. And he turned Andrews over to his war secretary, Edwin Stanton.
This sounds like something out of a Wild West movie.
Exactly.
The Wild Wild West.
Robert
Conrad, and then the movie with Will Smith. And
yeah, it makes you want to watch that series in a little bit of a different perspective now, doesn't it? So Andrews demonstrated his flying Aeron in front of reporters who wrote about it in the D.C. papers, and a bunch of Lincoln's War Department military officials.
Holy cow, this is Wild Wild West.
Yeah, and they were impressed with this. However, here's what we're told. We are told that in the end, Edwin Stanton said, this has no immediate application for us. This war is almost over. Thank you, but no thank you. Well, I disagree. I don't think that's true at all. My personal opinion is that the U.S. War Department did indeed buy this technology.
Well, it sounds like what the Navy did with T. Townsend Brown.
Yeah, and I think that they didn't do it during the war. Okay, here's the thing we got going against what I'm proposing here is we don't see in history where the Union started using flying machines. Well, here's why, in my opinion. Every ounce of resource was going into just a conventional war, okay? I think they procured this, they finished the war, and because, you know, the nation was under Reconstruction again, you know, try selling this to the people that you're going to go, you know, pursue building these boondoggle, you know, Vernon.
Yeah, wait, aren't you missing a huge thing here? Where did this information come from to create a technology you can demonstrate? And do you have the secret world and the white world? And when they come together again and again and again, the secret world wins because the honest world, the 3D world, the everyday reality we live in, you're not supposed to know any of this stuff is possible.
Right. Well, that's what's interesting is we're not told – we don't know the answer to your question about that. These guys – we have these inventors, these strange guys, this Solomon Andrews. We have the man in the Sonora Aero Club that built the Bell device and knew really all the secrets of how the arrows work was a German named Peter Menes. Peter Menes, you know
– You can't make this stuff up.
That's right, you know, and
Peter Menes, okay.
We don't know where Peter Menes got it from. We don't
German
know where
German named Peter
Andrews.
Menes, oh. Mm-hmm. Antecedent to the Nazis, Peter Menes. I'm sorry.
And so I argue that not only is the Edwin Stanton, you know, line about thanks but no thanks not true, I think the truth is the U.S. government did buy this technology, and after the war, what they did was they set up what was essentially the first American black technology project. In that, it was done in secret. The resources they had to go to industry, you know, industrial leaders and bankers, American bankers and stuff, to get the resources. Okay, to do this.
I'm just seeing a scene with Dr. Lovelace and the guy sitting around. I mean, come on, that's what it is.
That's kind of what it is there. And so here's the interesting thing, too. During the post-war era, post-Civil War era, was the era in which Samuel Tillman came up as a young Army guy, as a young Army officer. And when you look at Samuel Tillman, in his early years of his career, what he was a cartographer, an explorer for the U.S. Army. Okay? And he also, get this – He happened to be a chemist. He became a chemistry professor at West Point. Now,
did he make photographs, photographic plates, solutions, you know, fixers, developers?
That I don't know, but he.
Because if you take a camera, you know, a simple primitive camera from that era up in an arrow, and you're a cartographer and you put the photographs together and know something about geometry, you get the first really super accurate maps.
Sure.
Prior to the next war.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? And so you had Tillman, you know, in the early part of his career, he was coming up during what I propose was the, 20-something year period where this air on technology of Solomon Andrews was being developed secretly by the U.S. government, the U.S. military, by independent contractors. Again, the very definition of one of our black projects. These guys were the skunk works of their day.
My gosh. Did this guy, Andrews, did he develop it, or was it, as John West would say, a legacy from the ancient secret society filtering it through to the right military-industrial complex so there could be no tracing back to the origins for an agenda, for a mission?
That's my opinion, is that he learned about it through, you know, means he did not talk about.
Or was he picked? Did he learn, or was he picked as an agent?
Maybe. Who knows?
That's think you would. No, you wouldn't trust something like this. These have to be agents. These are sleepers. These are like you know, the old Quetzalcoatl myth.
Well, he apparently wasn't involved with it after this period that he pitched to the government. So, in my opinion, I think the government bought it and said, you know, thank you, Solomon. You know, we'll take it from here, and that it became that. That aforementioned black project. And
did
then
anything unusual show up in his bank account?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
But I did not dig that part out. I was following the other threads, but that's a good thing to note and take a look. He did build his Inventors Institute, made it larger, and started, you know, doing other things.
With so what funding from where? Are you
there
right
you
there?
Go.
It looks like the payoff to me.
Yeah, the payoff right there. And then by the 1890s, we have, you know, them break out with this publicly and kind of, I would say, do, you know, it's really they're testing the public's reaction, you might say. Let's come out with these things. And here you have Tillman now, who, you know, is being identified as one of the pilots.
See, that almost sounds to me, Walter, like it was a huge public psyop program.
Could be.
And the design was to land and interact with ordinary people.
Yes.
Get their reaction. This is before polls, so you'd have to actually have it as an experiment, field experiment. Guys land from sky, guys need, you know, ham sandwich, guys say, here, take this, you know.
Yep.
And they give names so that you ultimately can trace it back generations later. Why would a terrestrial group try to do this if they weren't trying to accelerate human technological and political progress?
Right. Very good point.
And did they then meet a counterforce, the black ops guys, the dark side of the force, that shut it down and diverted us into this insane 20th and 21st century we've lived through so far?
Actually, it was something a little different.
Okay.
I argue that their rivals were the German NIMSA, the Prussian NIMSA. Okay, however, I think...
The rivals to whom?
To this American Black Project.
Oh, okay, so we've got the original group, the Prussian group, is you think the dark guys, and the Splinter Off group is the light guys that want to give it to everybody, and they're... campaign lasted about 2 years and then got shut down somehow.
Well, it turned out that I don't think they wanted to give it to everybody. I think what happened then brings us into the early 1900s and the rumor, the legend that somebody using Tesla technology allegedly might have built an airship to attempt to go to Mars. Now, somewhere buried in that legend, I think, is a nugget of truth. And it was somewhere about there that I propose, based on all the stuff that's in my book and all the research I've done, I propose that at that point, the non-government guys, the guys in the program office who had developed these things, I think at that point they did not like the direction the 20th century was going with all the globalist bankers and all these things we now know about. And I think that was when this American group made its decision to break away.
Hmm. Now, where does H.G. Wells come into this? Because remember, he was writing in the 1890s.
Ooh, yeah.
Time travel. He also was writing about Cavorite and going to the moon with anti-gravity.
Exactly. Isn't that interesting? Because the Sonora Aero Club, part of Peter Menes's technology was chemicals, okay? Was one of the things he had developed that resulted in anti-gravity was this fuel that mixed certain type chemicals and certain type, I don't want to say gemstones, but, you know.
Crystals?
Yeah, that, you know, it was very much like Cavorite. Now, here's the thing with Wells. Wells was a Fabian socialist, and the Fabian socialists were very connected to the spiritualist.
Is that something like Bernie Sanders? No, I'm just kidding. Sorry, Bernie, just kidding.
The Fabian socialists were very much ingratiated with the spiritualist movement, you know, theosophy and things like that.
Okay? Helen Blavatsky, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. And they also were very much had the early 20th century German mystic types ingratiated with them, who went on to found the organizations that became the Nazis. Okay, the Fabian socialists, you know, guys like H.G. Wells and George Bernard Shaw. There's a wonderful human being I have no respect for. These guys pretty much were in line with the NIMSA influence, the German group influence, and so they would have fallen into the camp that was in that. Was like, you know, that I proposed was in opposition to the American.
Okay, you've mentioned this NIMSA group now several times. We got that it's a capital definition, but we never got into exploring what does it mean. If you take it apart linguistically, what does it mean?
Well, nobody has ever sufficiently been able to translate what NYMZA means. One of the most memorable efforts, which wasn't bad, and I understand why they did it, was the New York Motor Zephyr Association. But here's the problem with that. Delshow.
Is that like the Hells Angels, only back east?
Something like that, yeah. Delshow, Charles Delshow.
The artist.
Yeah. Our source of, you know, all things NIMSA, the original source that we have so far, he said flat out that NIMSA was a German organization headquartered in Germany. It was all German. So with that, a couple of books back, I realized, you know what, I've got to try to translate what this NIMSA was, and I got to think of it in terms of you know, it being a German organization.
Mm. So, Thule Society, etc.
Well, before that, yeah. So what I came up with transformed NYMZA through to NJMZA. Now, why is that? Because of transliteration, you know, without going into a long, you know, linguistics lesson here.
Well, define transliteration.
Transliteration is when you if I go to convey a word in a different language than you and I speak, a non-English word, and I try to convey a way for you to write that using our alphabet. Let's say it's a Russian word that uses the Cyrillic alphabet, okay? And you want to write this word using our alphabet. You would use our letters to, as closely as possible, match the pronunciation of that word that's originates in the Cyrillic alphabet. Okay? So you're not using the Cyrillic alphabet. You're using our alphabet. And I say that that's kind of how and why Delshow used, you know, what they called themselves, you know, the NIMSA, how he got his spelling NYMZA, when actually, and it's all in a couple of my books here, but essentially what I came up with, NIMSA, in my opinion, probably means the Nationalistische Jagdflugzeug Maschinen Zahlungsamt. Now, what does that mean in English? I say it means the Nationalist Pursuit Exploration Airship Program Office. And what was that?
It sounds perfectly German, perfectly logical.
Yeah, well, it was a
kind of like how the Nazis, the National Socialists, you know, in other words, it has a very mundane beginning.
I say that these NIMSA guys were probably the dark figure pulling the strings that led to the Nazis. Yeah, but who were these guys? What was the Nationalist Pursuit Exploration Airship Program Office? Okay, this was, and here's my definition.
Well, bureaucrats first and foremost. Come on.
Yeah, yeah, a distinctly Prussian nationalist organization dedicated to unified Germany's global superiority in active pursuit of influence and exploitation of the natural resources and industry of the Americas. That would be their mission statement.
Shorthand, if you think you're descended from the gods and their right to rule, and you've got really either bits and pieces of technology, oh my God, or at least blueprints, you think you're heirs to the gods and your God-given mission is to convert the rest of the world to bow down to you.
Now, these
were
the guys.
Okay, that seems very logical.
Yeah, and these were the guys who Del Shall says were the ones behind building airships in the 1850s. I want to draw your attention to in my
Hang on 1 second. We'll go to the after I just do this because Joseph and I've had this debate now for years, decades.
Right.
I say that that period from the 1920s through the 1940s, the rise of the Nazis and the rise of all that incredible technology, some of which now is just beginning to leak out, the anti-gravity stuff, the Bell stuff and all that. Mm-hmm. The greatest period of military industrialization in the history of the planet looked to me like somebody talked to somebody who knew a hell of a lot more than the Germans did at that time, which fits into your heritage.
That somebody who knew a hell of a lot more were the NIMSA.
The Nazis,
I'm convinced, were directly guided in their technology that they pursued by the NIMSA. Now, I want you to, and this ties in, actually, I'm glad you framed it that way, because if you go to my Radio with Pictures section and you look at number five, slide number five.
Number five.
Now,
love his artwork. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Look at this. This is so steampunk.
Yes. Now, that is something there that Charles Del Shall said they were going to build and fly. It was an example of what they built in 1856.
Well, it's certainly got the right appurtenances. It's got things that rotate. Remember, we make the physics work. It's rotation, rotation, rotation.
Right. Well, look at the general shape of that. What does that look like to you?
it looks like a flying saucer seen edgewise.
And we were seeing these things in the mid-20th century. Now, the fact that this was on the drawing board in 1856 is fascinating, just being on the drawing board. And when you think, well, you know, maybe it took, you know, 80, 70 years to, you know, finally develop that particular model. Mm-hmm. But that was something that was under the NIMSA aegis.
It's very Da Vinci-esque.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean by that, right?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes.
Da Vinci's sketches depict things, machines, but it could not work with the materials he had at the time. This almost hints to me a machine that requires additional development. So how do you get additional developments when you're living in a culture of stone knives and bearskins?
You get help.
No, you have to encourage development. If there's a prime directive, if you don't want to appear as a social disruption, you have to create the confluence so the culture itself will invent the tool of the tool of the tool that you need to do something.
Which is exactly what some people argue the Angelic Society was doing with Jules Verne.
Ah.
By giving him these things and write about this, write about that device, do this, do that.
Yep.
And look how many people it influenced. So here you have, by the early 20th century, you know, you have this American group, and of course you've had the German group that has been operating, according to Del Shall, at least since the 1850s. And we go into the 20th century knowing, you know, what we know, what the scholarship is on the, you know, the secret technologies.
Okay, when we come back, I want to go to number six, but we're at the bottom of the hour. Yes, we are. I hit it right, 50-50. Turning around. Okay. Number six slide is Bariloche. We're back to southern Argentina, to this German Nazi stronghold. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive, which only goes to show we need more practice. Here on the other side of midnight, my name is Richard C. Hoagland. Music by Keith Rowland. And we'll be right back. We shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight in the middle of our triptych. We've been trying to kind of organize the end shows of this week to tell a story. Last night was the development of democratized superconductive thrusters that will take us to Alpha Centauri in less than 4 years. Tonight we're looking back in time to who on Earth preserved this amazing technology and science from maybe thousands or tens of thousands of years ago. And it emerged in the late 19th, early 20th century as a set of bizarre experiments coordinated by a group out of Germany with American allies, and that's where we've traced the paper trail so far. Walter, where does the story take us next? And Greg, maybe you should jump in here with a question, because we're about to really accelerate at warp 9 on the story here.
Well, you recall that I had pulled a thread or stumbled across this mention of friends from Sonora in my investigation into the strange, mysterious deaths in San Bernardino in 1915. Mm-hmm. It offered another, really, the bombshell in my research. And, the other books go into this in detail. I'll leave people to discover that there. But essentially, the mystery woman who I mentioned who had died in the lake, poisoned and drowned in 1915, November 18th, 1915. She was a complete mystery. It was all over the newspapers here and in New York and other places. She lies buried under the name Cora Stanton in the Mountain View Cemetery here in San Bernardino. But Rick Spence and I, we were researching the first book. Neither one of us are convinced that that was her real name. In fact, I subsequently became convinced that her true identity was none other than Etta Place, the associate of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
What?
Right.
How many threads have we got going here? Oh, yeah. You got to fill that one out.
Here's the interesting thing. Now, how does it tie in further with this stuff? How in the heck did Etta Place end up in San Bernardino in 1915 to die mysteriously, as a so-called stranger? I have to kind of tell you a little bit.
You got 25 minutes.
That if, you know, if I'm right about this, I'm telling myself, you know, there had to have been a reason she was here in San Bernardino. And it just so happens that San Bernardino, I think even today, but more so then, San Bernardino was a major railroad hub in the southwestern United States. If it went from California to the east, it came through San Bernardino and vice versa. Okay, major railroad hub. Now, at the time, in 1915, of course, World War I was going strong. And the United States was not in the war yet, of course. In May of 1915, the Lusitania had been sunk. So in the fall of 1915, you know, more American sabers were rattling, but we weren't in the war yet. But at that time, there was going on a huge amount of espionage between Germany and England. You see, because of the shipping lanes and all this stuff, the Germans and the British agents were all over California. because, as it was discovered, and this is history now, it was discovered that the Germans were smuggling guns to the rebel fighters in India. They wanted to keep England busy on, you know, two fronts. So they were smuggling guns. They would bring them up through the Gulf of Mexico, through Texas, across the Southwest, and then they would put them on boats in San Diego and sail those boats across the Pacific to Burma, what was Burma, which is Myanmar now. And they would, the Indians would, East Indians would take possession of the guns there. Well, the Germans were doing this, smuggling this through California. Now, through my research and the history, if they were bringing these guns and they were using the rail, if they were bringing them on rail across the American Southwest to San Diego yard here at San Bernardino, which made San Bernardino a hotbed of espionage foreign agent activity. Now, what did that mean? That meant that there were English spies here in San Bernardino, there were German spies, there were likely East Indian spies, because at the time the Hindu-German conspiracy was huge in California. Their agents were sabotaging boats in ports from LA to San Francisco. It was huge back then, almost forgotten now. Now, here's the interesting thing. At the time, there was no FBI, okay? The only federal agency that worked national security issues was the U.S. Secret Service.
Yes.
Okay?
We're back to Wild Wild West. This is amazing.
Yeah, you have this circumstances, okay? And she's identified as a suicide. Now, remember, this is 1915. Now, this suicide, interestingly enough, when she's finally buried, it's several days later, like almost 2 weeks later. And here's the interesting thing. She's unidentified until somebody allegedly finds a purse with a suicide note in a spot that had already been searched by the police, and nothing was found. Hmm. Some guy just stumbles upon this. Oh, it identifies her. A jury is put together really quickly. They say, oh, yeah, she was a suicide, okay? And then she's given a full official funeral by the Episcopalian minister, okay? And this woman's a suicide, remember. In 1915, the Episcopalian Church would never have approved of a suicide having a formal church funeral. So you got to ask yourself, isn't this interesting? What did this minister know about this woman who was being buried? Well, it just so happens that the Episcopalian Church in America has a long history with the U.S. intelligence community. Okay.
Oh, that's special.
Yes, isn't that interesting? And the other interesting thing was the news of this woman's death, this mystery woman's death, as I said before, was in newspapers in New York, in Utah, up in San Francisco. People came from San Francisco to attend her funeral. Her funeral was attended by several people. And again, it was officiated by the local Episcopalian minister.
This now, for a Jane Doe suicide.
For a Jane Doe suicide, an alleged suicide. Now, if the Episcopalian Church at that time would not have given a formal church service to a suicide, then they must have known, because they did it. They must have known that she was not a suicide. I propose that they knew she was murdered. And therefore, how would they know this? Because they probably knew she was an agent. Remember, the Episcopalian Church Association of the U.S. Intelligence Community was strong. Okay, so they must have known she was an agent.
So I'm trying to remember the movie and the novel. Did they go to Bolivia or Peru? I forget which one.
Bolivia.
And Bolivia, and they're killed. Was she with them?
Argentina first. Well, first, no, she was not. See, there's the interesting thing. Now, how did I figure out that Cora Stanton was at a place? Well, that was when I was trying to, you know, answer these weird questions that were left by her death. And I was looking at one of the other deaths, and I was looking on a list of famous or known people who disappeared in the United States, you know, going back 100 or whatever years.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the funny thing. I saw Etta Place's name on that list. And I thought, I didn't know that her fate was unknown. Because here's the thing. She returned to the United States from South America, Argentina. Okay, Longaball, Sundance came with her, escorted her back. She returned to the United States in 1906, and Longaball, Sundance, went back.
Hmm.
Okay, her last known place of residence was San Francisco. Okay, now
so
when you look,
so hang on. How does slide number 6 enter into this?
Okay, when she hooked up, it. What I'm explaining now ties in with how did the church know her as an agent?
Mm-hmm.
Because the woman that was pulled out of the lake in 1915 was roughly around 35 years old, and she was a virgin. Okay.
Oh.
So I asked myself, a 35-year-old woman who's a virgin, gosh, maybe she was a nun. And lo and behold, the Episcopalian Church had orders of secular nuns.
Oh,
and I go into the details in my book, but I argue that that's how the Episcopalian Church knew who and what she really was. And they knew she was also an agent.
So she was a member of the order, whatever order we're talking
well,
about.
Well, no. Yeah, yeah. She was a member of some order. Mm-hmm. There's some that I suggest, but we can't be sure.
Was her time with the guys, was that part of her mission?
Yes, it was, because I argue she was recruited sometime in the 1890s by the U.S. Secret Service, and that she was already a field operative for the Secret Service at the time she met Butch and Sundance. Now, get this.
So did they go to South America not because they just wanted to rob more banks, but because they were on a mission?
Right.
A secret
exactly.
mission.
Yes. See, she was assigned.
Walter, you can't do this. We're toward the end of the second hour. You can't leave us up in the air here.
I'm not going to leave you in the air. I'm getting to it. I'm tying all these threads together now. She was recruited. She was a Secret Service operative. Okay?
This is Etta and now.
This is Etta Place. The woman we know is Etta Place. And Butch and Sundance used to hang out in the same brothel that William Pinkerton.
Oh, my God. Hung another name from that era. This is Wild Wild West.
William Pinkerton and his brother had taken over the Pinkerton Agency that was founded by their father, Alan. And do you know who Alan Pinkerton was before the founder of that agency? He was Abraham Lincoln's spymaster and the founder of what became the U.S. Secret Service. The U.S. Secret Service and the Pinkerton Agency go back a long time, and I argue in my book and present the evidence that that is the real reason why the Pinkertons could allegedly never catch Butch and Sundance, and that is because Etta was assigned to the gang and reporting to the Secret Service initially because they were robbing banks and money. What's that? That's treasury, right?
Right.
Services treasury.
Yep.
Okay. Now, then they
let me interrupt.
The Germans.
What was their talent that they would have been hired as secret agents by the Secret Service? What was the big thing
Etta.
That Butchin did?
Well, Etta. Etta was the primary field officer for the Secret Service. Well, she could, you know, being a woman in those days.
No. What was their talent? Why hire them? Why send them to South America, to Bolivia?
Well, that's what I just said. That's what I was getting to, is actually their journey to South America was on in the service of a deal, I argue, they made with E.H. Harriman, the president of the Union Pacific Railroad, which they had robbed and robbed and robbed, and then suddenly quit robbing. And this happened, we're told, if you look at the history of Butch Cassidy, and I have to say there's a bunch of Western historians that hate me for it, okay? They say it's hogwash. They haven't looked close enough, okay? They have not looked close enough. Here's the thing. Butch Cassidy at one point wanted amnesty. He wanted out of this life. He went to Governor Wells of Utah and asked Governor Wells for amnesty. Governor Wells said, I cannot give that to you. You must go to the man who you've been robbing, and that's E.H. Harriman.
Mm.
We are told then that Butch just said, forget it. I want to be an outlaw, and that meeting never happened. Here's the funny thing, though. After this period of time, they only rob a Union Pacific train one more time, and then get this. After that, suddenly, the gang that was the best at what they did, the most legendary at the time, no one could catch, suddenly they couldn't do anything right. They would go to rob a bank or rob a train or whatever, and the posse would already be there. Okay, they would get into gunfights, and their guys would get killed. And here's the funny thing. This was about the time that Butch and Sundance quit going on the heists with them. Now, I'm a former federal agent. When I see something like that, these bank robbing, train robbing guys, suddenly the two main guys quit going on the heists, and the heists start going bad, and the cops are there when they arrive. Okay, somebody's tipped somebody off. Okay? Now, I argue that Butch Cassidy made the deal with E.H. Harriman. Okay? Because it was shortly after that that he and Sundance with Etta went down to South America and bought ranch property in Argentina, not far south of Bariloche, in a little place called Cholila.
Everybody winds up going to Bariloche. What the hell is there?
Well, here's the interesting thing. Now, how does Greg, this all tie
Walter, stop a second. Greg, you've been incredibly quiet. What's up? I know you had something you wanted to say.
I was wondering about the Solomon Andrews and Samuel Tillman, if any of them had connections with
Skype dropped out.
West or
yeah, you may have to say that again, Greg. Or, Skype dropped out.
Or with oh, wait a minute, did I drop out?
Yeah, go ahead, say it again.
Oh, with Major Powell or with Edgar Rice Burroughs and the
well, Edgar Rice Burroughs was in the Army in the late 19th century out in the West in Arizona. I think that he might very well have witnessed, you know, some of the airship stuff. And I haven't pulled the thread yet. It's out there for somebody to pull. Maybe, you know, he had some assignment connection to, you know, Samuel Tillman. Who knows? But it is a very interesting point. But, that's. But I was getting to the German connection between Butch.
Okay. Thanks, Greg.
And all of this. E.H. Harriman, when he purchased the Union Pacific, okay, he was basically he got the money to do it. He was staked, okay, by Kuhn Loeb, a very well-known bank in America founded by two German immigrants. Okay, that at one time owned well over 60% of all the physical rail line in the United States.
Oh,
they were the rail bankers, and they were German immigrants. And I suspect that they were tied to NIMSA, and I propose that the deal with Harriman was Harriman told Butch, you guys go get out of the country, go down to South America. We want you to establish a ranch down there in a particular area. And I argue that it's very possible that Harriman and the Cassidy Ranch basically made it possible for a NIMSA base of the German airships to operate out of Argentina in their search in the Andes for the sources of lost gold and possibly the lost technology.
Oh, my God. And that's slide number 6 in your section tonight on Radio with Pictures.
And Etta Place was there. She was already attached with them, and she went with them and was likely reporting whatever encounters they had with NIMSA and what was going on down there to the Secret Service. Now, here's an interesting thing. The guy for Pinkerton who was in South America, who, again, oh golly, could never seem to catch them, his name was Frank DeMeo, okay, a longtime Pinkerton guy. Frank DeMeo began his career going undercover in a prison for the U.S. Secret Service. So Frank DeMeo's early part of his career had a connection to the U.S. Secret Service. We have no reason to believe that his connection to Secret Service, his operational connection, ever ended. And he was the guy who Pinkerton sent down to hunt down and stalk Butch Cassidy and Etta Place and all of them. I argue not only was that, you know, a cover, I argue that he was down there on behalf of Secret Service as her go-between. I say that she would report to Frank, give her reports to Frank DeMeo, and he would forward them onto the Secret Service and, you know, provide them with whatever logistical, you know, things she needed. I think that's what was going on with Butch Cassidy and the Cassidy Ranch down there and Sundance and Etta. And she returned to the United States, and her duties 9 years later led her to her her assassination in San Bernardino in 1915.
So any speculation as to why she was killed in San Bernardino?
Yeah. You know, there's various possibilities. She, you know, it could be just the spy game. You know, the German agents figured out she was an American agent and she had to go. Or, as my Empire of the Wheel books propose, not only did she have to go because of that, but was a major working of black magic. They needed sacrifices. They needed, you know, ritual sacrifices. And she was there for, you know, a convenient sacrifice. So there you have it.
So if the ranch was being used to establish a 19th century, 20th century base of this Prussian group in South America.
19th century, yeah.
How does that then turn into the meeting place of the planet where, as far as we now know, Greg has tracked 39 heads of state all going to Bariloche? What the heck is going on?
Knowing this now, now that I've told you my theory of what Butch and Sundance and Etta were actually doing and for whom and where, Bariloche is not that far north from Cholila, where the ranch was. I propose that the Cassidy Ranch was actually the early presence of what, you know, these Germans in the in that region of Argentina, and led to being a Nazi refuge. I think that is because of the NIMSA presence down there years before.
Interesting. So let's go back to the key question. The NIMSA group, the secret Prussian group, the secret society, the semi-priesthood that wants to, like in the 1930s film, you know, the things to come, to reorder the world in its image based on secret technology. What happened to your search back to them? Do we have any data as to what civilization was preserved that these guys then tried to run with in the middle and the later parts of the 19th century?
You know, the only thing I can offer on that is that, you know, it I try to show a tracing back to, you know, the legends of those who came from the sky, you know, and came down and set themselves up as gods, so to speak, when they were actually just a technologically advanced civilization. They could have come from Mars. They could have come from anywhere. And, you know, they came here. They established their strongholds, their cities and such. And then, you know, as they stayed, you know, the Earth-based humans, you know, learned this technology and such and continued it on. And with time, it became ours, so to speak, you know, just from the human Earth-human past. And that's really the book goes into a little bit more detail, but that's really the gist of, you know, as far as I've taken it. As far as who they are now, when I show the line between, you know, the German technology and the German banking people, and German mystics and people like that, who I name in the origin book, you see how it spans from the 1850s era of the Sonora Aero Club and the Prussian NIMSA across the rest of the 19th century and into the 20th century to the World War II era. I mean, it starts with and let me go down here, because I think you know, you got guys like Friedrich Waniek and Karl Kellner and Walter Rathenau and Halmer Schacht. Okay, you know, these are it goes back to Karl Reichenbach in the early 19th century. Well, these guys you can kind of tie together and show that they were the natural progression into the 20th century, and through Schacht and Rathenau, we have a direct Nazi connection.
Okay, we need to define one crucial thing to frame this whole conversation tonight.
Uh-huh.
What is a breakaway civilization?
Oh, gosh. Dolan defined that so well, but in a nutshell, in the sentence, it's, in my opinion, the resources who just decide to go their own way. And, you know, socially, economically, technologically, they just decide to go their own way. And I think that's what I call the American group did. I think the NIMSA, the German group, they've got their own way, but I think they decided to stick around. They're the ones who are behind the globalists, the Nazis, the New World Order, the Nazi International.
This is the German from the Prussian original NIMSA group.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. All your New World Order of today, your Nazi International, your globalist elitists who are trying to make us slaves, so to speak. These guys, their threat, in my opinion, goes back to the 19th century NIMSA.
Okay. So who are the other guys? Who are opposed to them?
They are who I refer to as the American group. I sometimes call them the 1903, because I think whatever the nugget of truth is about that airship to Mars story, whatever the nugget of truth is in there, I think what you're looking at is the point at which this American group, again, like I said, they did not like the direction the 20th century was going, and they decided to heck with it. We've got this technology. Whatever actually happened in 1903 with that effort to go out in space, they realized, wow, you know what? This is our time now to just do this. And they went. And I think they're philosophically opposed to NIMSA and what NIMSA and the others I named are all about.
Hmm. It does sound like something right out of Lewis Carroll. Okay, we're at the end of the show. Yeah. I want you to be able to plug your website, okay? Because there's a lot more information there. And the books you've written a series. The one I'm holding is called Origin, the 19th Century Emergence of the 20th Century Breakaway Civilizations, with data, evidence, a paper trail. Amazing work, Walter. Really amazing
work. Thank you. It's my blog is empiretheWheel.blogspot.com. And, of course, my author's page at Amazon is where you can find all my books on Kindle. I do, for those who like the printed books, you can go to lulu.com and, you know, look, put in my name and you can get print on demand. And, I really appreciate you having me on, Richard. This has been a lot of fun, and I appreciate the interest.
Well, thank you. My guest this morning has been Walter Bosley. We've been discussing the origins back before the 19th century in his model of what's now become the 20th century and 21st century breakaway civilizations, which are poised, in our model, to do something before the end of the year. The fabled D-word. Tomorrow morning we bring it all together with evidence of the civilization all around us in the solar system. So until then, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.